Chapter 8 Sirius at Cambridge. When the holiday was over, Thomas took Sirius to Cambridge. A private bed sitting room had been prepared for the wonder dog within the precincts of the laboratory, near a room which Thomas occupied himself. The senior members of the staff were introduced to Sirius as man to man, on the understanding that they must keep the secret and behave in public as though this dog were only a rather specially bright super sheepdog. Sirius was at first very happy at Cambridge. The bustle of city and university, though rather bewildering, was stimulating. During the first few days, he spent much time in wandering about the streets, watching the people and the dogs. The abundance of the canine population surprised him, and so did the extraordinary diversity of breeds. It seemed to him incredible that the dominant species should keep so many of the dominated species alive in complete idleness, for not one of these pampered animals had any function but to be the living toy of some man or woman. Physically, they were nearly all in good condition, save for a common tendency to corpulence, which in some cases reached a disgusting fulfilment. Mentally, they were unwholesome. How could it be otherwise? They had nothing to do but wait for their meals, sink from boredom into sleep, attend their masters or mistresses on gentle walks, savour one another's odours, and take part in the simple ritual of the lamp-post and the gate-post. Sexually, they were all starved, for bitches were few and jealously guarded by their human owners. Had not the canine race been of subhuman intelligence, they must once and all have been neurotics, but their stupidity saved them. Sirius himself had often to act the part of these subhuman creatures. When Elizabeth took him out to visit her friends, he allowed himself to be petted and laughed at or praised for the marvellous intelligence that he showed in shaking hands or shutting the door. Then the company would forget him completely while he lay stretched out on the floor in seeming boredom, but in fact listening to every word and trying to get the hang of some conversation on books or painting, even furtively stealing a glance at drawings or bits of sculpture that were circulated for inspection. Elizabeth did her best to give Sirius a fair sample of life in a university city. It became a sort of game with her to contrive means to insinuate him into meetings and concerts. After the simple subsistence life of the sheep country, Cambridge filled him with respect for the surplus energies of the human species. All these great and ornate buildings had been put up, stone by stone, century by century, with the cunning of human hands. All these articles in shop windows had been made by human machinery and transported in human trains, cars, and ships from the many lands of human occupation. Perhaps most impressive of all to his innocent mind was the interior of a great library, where, by patient intrigue, Elizabeth managed to effect an entry for him. The thousands of books lining the walls brought home to him as nothing else had done the vast bulk and incredible detail of human intellectual tradition. He stood speechless before it all, his tail drooping with awe. As yet he was far too simple-minded to realise that the majority of the volumes that faced him, shoulder to shoulder, were of little importance. He supposed all to be mightily pregnant, and the naive belief that he could never attain wisdom until his poor eyes had travelled along most of those millions of lines of print filled him with despair. Thomas had decided that the time had come to let out the secret of Sirius's powers to a carefully selected public. A number of his scientific and academic friends must be allowed to make the dog's acquaintance and form their own opinions of his ability, on the understanding that the truth must not yet be published. His policy was still to keep the greater public from sharing the secret, lest the forces of commercial stunt manufacture should be brought to bear on his work and possibly wreck it. He arranged for Sirius to meet a few eminent persons in the university, mostly zoologists, biochemists, biologists of one sort or another, but also psychologists, philosophers, and philologists who would be interested in his speech, and a few stray surgeons, painters, sculptors, and writers who happened to be among Thomas's personal friends. These meetings generally took place after a lunch in Thomas's rooms. Over the meal, Thomas would tell the party something about his experiments and the success of the super sheepdogs. Then he would lead on to his more daring research and describe Sirius as probably quite as bright as most university students. When lunch was over, the small company would settle in easy chairs with their pipes, and Thomas, looking at his watch, would say, "I told him we should be ready for him at 2 o'clock. He'll be along in a minute." Presently the door would open, and the great beast would stalk into the room. He did not lack presence, tall and lean as a tiger, but with a faint suggestion of the lion's mane, he would stand for a moment looking at the company. Thomas would rise to his feet and solemnly introduce his guests one by one to Sirius. "Professor Stone, anthropologist. Dr. James Crawford, president of college," and so on. The guests generally felt extremely ill at ease, not knowing how to behave, and often suspecting that Thomas was playing a trick on them. Sometimes they remained stolidly seated, sometimes rather sheepishly rose to their feet, as though Sirius were a distinguished human newcomer. Sirius looked steadily into the eyes of each guest as he was introduced, acknowledging him with a languid movement of his great flag of a tail. He would then take up his position in the centre of the company, generally squatting down on the hearthrug. "Well," Thomas would say, "first of all, you want to know, of course, that Sirius really can understand English. So, will someone ask him to do something?" Often the whole company was so paralysed by the oddity of the situation that it took a full half minute for anyone to think of an appropriate task. At last the dog would be asked to fetch a cushion or a book, which of course he straightway did. Presently Thomas would carry on a conversation with Sirius, the guests listening intently to the strange canine speech and failing to understand a word of it. Then Sirius would say a few simple words very slowly, Thomas translating. This would lead on to a general conversation, in which the guests would often question the dog and receive the answer through Thomas. Not infrequently, Sirius himself would question the visitors, and sometimes his questions were such that Thomas was obviously reluctant to pass on. In this way, the guests received a clear impression of a strong and independent personality. And in this way, Sirius himself gradually reached certain conclusions about these distinguished specimens of the dominant species. One characteristic about them perplexed him greatly. It was such a deep-seated thing that they themselves did not seem to be aware of it. One and all, they undervalued or misvalued their hands. Many of them, in fact all but the surgeons, sculptors, painters and research workers, were wretchedly clumsy with their hands, and by no means ashamed of it. Even those whose work involved manual skill, the surgeons, sculptors, and so on, though they were so skilled in their own specialized technique, had often lost that general handiness, that manual versatility by which their species had triumphed. On the whole, they were helpless creatures. Hands were for them highly specialized instruments, like the bird's wing or the seal's flipper, excellent for some one action, but not versatile. Those that came on bicycles never mended their punctures themselves. They could not sew on their buttons or mend their socks. Moreover, even these specialized geniuses of the hand had to some extent been infected by the general contempt for manual toil, which the privileged class had invented to excuse their laziness. As for the writers, academics, lawyers, politicians, their unhandiness and their contempt for mere manual dexterity were amazing. The writers couldn't even write properly. They fell back on the cruder activity of pressing typewriter keys, or they simply dictated. Sirius had heard that in old China the scholar class let their fingernails grow fantastically long so that their incapacity for manual work should be obvious. Think of the millions of cunning hands thus wasted. How he despised these regressive human types for the neglect and atrophy of the most glorious human organ, the very instrument of creation, and for infecting with their contempt for manual skill even the manual workers themselves, on whose practical dexterity the whole structure of civilization was founded. Artisans actually wanted their son to rise into the class of black-coated workers. What would not Sirius himself have achieved if he had been given even the clumsy hands of an ape, let alone the least apt of all these neglected human organs? The first few weeks at Cambridge were indeed delightful for Sirius. Every morning some bit of research was done upon him at the laboratory with his interested cooperation. Sometimes it was a case of studying his motor or sensory reactions, sometimes his glandular responses to emotional stimuli, sometimes his intelligence, and so on. X-ray photographs had to be made of his skull, gramophone records of his speech. With the cooperation of a psychologist, he himself planned to write a monograph on his olfactory experiences, and another on his power of detecting human character and emotional changes by scent and tone of voice. Psychologists and musicians studied his musical powers. His sex life had also to be recorded. In addition to all this strictly scientific work in which Sirius collaborated with his human observers, he planned to undertake two popular books entirely on his own. One was to be called The Lamp Post, a study of the social life of the domestic dog. The opening passage is interesting for the light which it throws on Sirius's temperament. In man, social intercourse has centred mainly on the process of absorbing fluid into the organism. But in the domestic dog, and to a lesser extent among all wild canine species, the act charged with most social significance is the excretion of fluid. For man, the pub, the estaminet, the beer garden, but for the dog, the tree trunk, the lintel of door or gate, and above all the lamppost, form the focal points of community life. For a man, the flavours of alcoholic drinks. For a dog, the infinitely variegated smells of urine are the most potent stimuli for the gregarious impulse. The other projected book, Beyond the Lamppost, he kept a dead secret. It was to be autobiographical and would express his philosophy of life. These works were never completed. The second was scarcely even begun. But I have found the random notes for it extremely useful in writing Sirius's biography. They reveal a mind which combined laughable naivety in some directions with remarkable shrewdness in others. A mind, moreover, which seemed to oscillate between a heavy, self-pitying seriousness and a humorous detachment and self-criticism. It was flattering to Sirius to be the centre of so much interest, and it was very unwholesome. Inevitably, he began to feel that his mission was, after all, simply to be his unique self, and to allow the human race respectfully to study him. Far from retaining the humility that had oppressed him on his visit to the library, he now swung away towards self-complacency. As his presence became more widely known, more people sought his acquaintance. Thomas received innumerable invitations from outside the chosen circle, persons who had evidently heard vague rumours of the human dog, and were eager to verify them. When Sirius was out in the streets, people often stared at him and whispered. Thomas strongly disapproved of his going out by himself, lest attempts should be made to kidnap him. The anxious physiologist even went so far as to hint that unless his precious charge agreed never to go out without a human escort, he would have to be confined to the laboratory. This threat, however, infuriated Sirius, and Thomas recognised that if it were carried out, all friendly cooperation would cease. The best he could do was to engage a detective to follow the dog on a bicycle whenever he went out of doors. Sirius conceived a humorous dislike of this individual. "He's rather like a tin can tied to my tail, he and his clattery old bike," said Sirius, and henceforth always referred to him as Old Tin Can. The game of giving Old Tin Can the slip, or leading him into awkward situations, became Sirius's main outdoor amusement. Contrary to his original intention, Sirius spent the whole of that autumn term at Cambridge. Though he was often very homesick for the country, and nearly always had a headache and often felt seedy, he found Cambridge life far too fascinating to surrender. Several times he did indeed suggest to Thomas that he ought to be moving on, but Thomas was reluctant to break off the research, and Sirius himself was too comfortable to find energy to press the matter. Very soon the Christmas vacation was upon him, and he went back to Wales with Thomas, Elizabeth, and Plaxey. Once more on the hills, he discovered that he was in a sorry state of physical decay, and he spent much of his time trying to restore himself by long hunting expeditions. During the spring term, Sirius was less happy. The glamour of Cambridge had begun to fade, and he was increasingly restless about his future, the more so because Cambridge was like a habit-forming drug. By now he obtained only a mild satisfaction from it, yet it had got into his blood and he could not bring himself to do without it. He had arrived in Cambridge an anatomical study of bone and muscle. A soft, inactive life, which included far too many delicacies received in the houses of admiring acquaintances, had already blurred his contours with a layer of fat and filled out his waist. Once when he met Plaxey in the street, she exclaimed, "Gosh, you're going fat and prosperous, and you waddle like a Pekingese." This remark had greatly distressed him. Along with physical decay went a less obvious mental decay, a tendency to sink into being a sort of super-lapdog-come-super-laboratory animal. His disposition became increasingly peevish and self-centred. There came a day when a serious difference occurred between Sirius and McBain. Thomas's lieutenant had prepared a piece of apparatus for a more minute research into Sirius's olfactory powers. Sirius protested that he was not in the mood for such an exacting bit of work today. His nose was in a hypersensitive state and must not be put to any strain. McBain pointed out that if Sirius refused, hours of preparation would be wasted. Sirius flew into a whimpering tantrum, crying that his nose was more important than a few hours of McBain's time. "Good God!" cried McBain. "You might be a prima donna!" Thomas had been surprised and pleased at the way in which Sirius had settled down to his new life. It seemed as though the dog had outgrown his romantic cravings and was reconciled to becoming a permanent property at the lab. But in his second term, although Sirius was still superficially able to enjoy his work, on a deeper level of his mind he was becoming increasingly perturbed and rebellious. This life of ease and self-gratulation was not at all what he was meant for. The mere shortage of physical exercise made him miserable. Sometimes he cantered a few miles along the towpath, but this was very boring, and he was always oppressed by the knowledge that the faithful detective was following on a bicycle. He could not force himself to run every day. Consequently, he was generally constipated and disgruntled. He felt a growing nostalgia for the moors, the mists, the rich smell of the sheep, with all its associations of hard work and simple triumphs. He remembered Pew with affection, and thought how much more real he seemed than these dons and their wives. He was vaguely aware, too, of his own moral decay. It was increasingly difficult for him to do anything that he did not want to do. Not that he was incapable of all mental effort, for he still generally carried out his intellectual work with conscientious thoroughness. But then, he happened to like that. What he was failing to do was to control his ordinary, selfish impulses in relation to his human neighbours. He was also growing less capable even of prudential self-regard. For instance, there was the matter of bitches. Of the few bitches that he encountered in Cambridge streets, most were anyhow too small for him, and many had been treated with a preparation which disguised the animal's intoxicating natural odour and made potential lovers regard her as a filthy-smelling hag. He insisted to Thomas that, since in Cambridge there was practically no scope at all for love-making, bitches must be provided for him. It was not to be expected that a vigorous young dog should be able to do without them and yet maintain his mental balance. So a succession of attractive females were procured for him. These creatures were brought in turn and at appropriate times to his rooms in the laboratory, and the whole matter was treated as part of the prolonged and complicated scientific study in which he was cooperating. The laboratory, by the way, had analysed the chemistry of the odours which were sexually stimulating to Sirius, and could choose seductive animals for him with considerable success. But his appetite, instead of being assuaged, increased. Almost daily they brought a young bitch to his room, yet he was never satisfied. Indeed, he became more and more lascivious and difficult to please. Thomas urged him to take himself in hand, otherwise his mental vitality would be sapped. Sirius agreed to do this, but failed to carry out his promise. And now a note of sadism crept into his lovemaking. Once there was a terrible commotion because, in the very act of love, he dug his teeth into the bitch's neck. This incident seems to have frightened Sirius himself, for a change now came over him. Dreading the dark power that seemed to rise up within him and control his behaviour, he made a desperate effort to pull himself together. He also determined to leave Cambridge at once and go back to Wales for a spell with the sheep. Thomas reluctantly agreed that he had better go, but pointed out that he was in no condition to undertake sheep work again without some weeks of severe physical training. This was all too true. The best that could be done was that Thomas should arrange with Pew to take him for a month, not as a sheepdog, but as a paying guest. This plan was much discussed, but somehow Sirius could not bring himself to such an ignominious course. In default of a better policy, he simply stayed on at Cambridge till the end of the term. There followed an Easter vacation in Wales, given over wholly to physical training, in preparation for a spell of sheep-tending in Cumberland. But as no satisfactory arrangement could be made for him, the lure of Cambridge proved in the end too strong, and he returned with Thomas for the summer term. In the familiar environment, the old way of life proved fatally easy. Laboratory work, meetings with Thomas's scientific or academic friends, a great deal of desultory biological and other scientific reading, a certain amount of philosophy, the writing of his monographs and notes for The Lamp Post and Beyond the Lamp Post, select parties at which he was lionized by the wives of dons, the perennial shortage of exercise, a succession of bitches, all this told upon his health and loosened his character. He developed more and more the prima donna disposition. He became increasingly self-centred and self-important. Yet all the while, deep in his heart, he felt completely disorientated and futile, spiritually enslaved to the will of man. At last, when he felt in himself a return of sadistic impulses, he was seized with such a terror of sheer madness that he once more gathered all his moral strength together for a great recovery. He set himself a course of strict self-discipline and asceticism. He would have no more bitches. He would cut down his food by half. Sometimes he would fast and pray to whatever gods there be. He would take exercise. He would cooperate conscientiously with the laboratory staff in their researches on him. He would once more tackle his literary work. For even this, which had for long been his one remaining active interest, had recently been dropped. For a while he did indeed live a more austere life, punctuated by bouts of wild self-indulgence. But presently his resolution began once more to fail, and he found himself slipping back into the old ways. Terror seized him, and a desperate loneliness in the midst of his social contacts. He felt a violent need for Plaxy, and sent her a note, asking her to come for a good walk with him. Plaxy gladly made an appointment with him, but the day was not a success. She was naturally very absorbed in her university life, and though Sirius was in a manner a member of the same university, their experiences did not overlap. Lectures, essays, meetings, dances, and above all her new friendships filled her mind with matter that was remote from Sirius. At first they talked happily and freely, but there was no depth of intimacy between them. Several times he was on the verge of blurting out his troubles, but to say, "Oh, Plaxy, help me, I'm going to hell," which was what he wanted to say, seemed somehow preposterous. Moreover, as the day wore on, he began to suspect, from a faint change in her odour, that she was growing subconsciously hostile to him. He had been talking to her about the bitches. It was then that her scent had begun to take on a slight asperity, though in speech and manner she remained quite friendly. Towards the end of the day a gloomy silence fell upon them both. Each tried to dispel it with light talk, but vainly. When at last they were on the point of parting, and Plaxy had said it was nice to be together again, Sirius registered in his own mind the fact that her odour had been growing mellower as the parting approached. "Yes, it's good indeed," he said. But even as he said it, the human smell of her, though unchanged in its sensory quality, began to nauseate him. In order to return to the laboratory, he had to cross the town. He strolled off, without any positive desire to reach his destination, or indeed to do anything else. As he drifted along the streets, he felt stifled by the surrounding herd of the grotesque super-simians who had conquered the earth, moulded the canine species as they trimmed their hedges and produced his unique self. Feelings of violent hatred surged up in him. A number of significant little memories presented themselves to his embittered mind. Long ago in a field near Festiniog, he had come upon an angel-faced little boy taking baby thrushes out of a nest and skewering them one by one on a rusty nail. More recently, in a Cambridge garden, he had watched a well-dressed woman sitting on a seat and fondling a dog's head. Presently she looked about as though to see if she was being observed. There was no one but Sirius, a mere animal. Still stroking the dog with one hand, she reached out with the other and pressed her lighted cigarette end into the creature's groin. This streak of sexual cruelty in human beings horrified Sirius all the more, because he himself had indulged in something of the sort with his bitches. But he persuaded himself that this aberration in him was entirely due to some sort of infection from man, due, in fact, to his human conditioning. His own kind, he told himself, were not by nature cruel. Oh, no, they always killed as quickly as possible. Only the inscrutable and devilish cat descended to torture. It was all due to man's horrible selfishness, he told himself. Homo sapiens was an imperfectly socialized species, as its own shrewder specimens, for instance, H.G. Wells, had pointed out. Even dogs, of course, were self-centered, but also far more spontaneously social. They might often fight for bones or bitches, and they persecuted one another for the glory of dominance, but when they were social, they were more wholeheartedly social. They were much more ready to be loyal, absolutely, without any secret nosing after self-advantage. So he told himself. They could give absolute, disinterested loyalty. For instance, to the human family that claimed their pack allegiance, or to a single adored master, or to the work that was entrusted to them. The sheepdog didn't expect to get anything out of his job. He did it for the work's sake alone. He was an artist. No doubt some men were as loyal as any dog, but Cambridge life had taught Sirius to smell out self-regard under every bit of loyalty. Even Plax's affection for him seemed, in his present mood, merely a sort of living up to a pattern for her precious self, not real, self-oblivious love. Or take McBain. Was it science, or the budding great scientist, Hugh McBain, that really stirred him? Sirius had noticed that he smelt most excited and eager whenever some little personal triumph was at stake. Then there were all those prominent people that he had met at Thomas's lunch parties. Biologists, physicists, psychologists, doctors, surgeons, academics, writers, painters, sculptors, and God knows what all. They were so very distinguished, and all so seeming modest, and so seeming friendly. And yet every one of them, every bloody one of them, if he could trust his nose and his sensitive ears, was itching for personal success, for the limelight, or, worse, scheming to push someone else out of the limelight, or make someone in it look foolish or ugly. No doubt dogs would be just as bad, really, except when their glorious loyalty was upon them. That was the point. Loyalty with dogs could be absolute and pure. With men it was always queered by their inveterate self-love. God! They must be insensitive, really, drunk with self, and insensitive to all else. There was something reptilian about them, snakish. Long ago, he had idealized humanity. His silly, uncritical canine loyalty had made him do so. But now his practiced nose had found out the truth about the species. They were cunning brutes, of course, devilishly cunning. But they were not nearly so consistently intelligent as he had thought. They were always flopping back into subhuman dullness, just as he was himself. And they didn't know themselves even as well as he knew himself, and not half as well as he knew them, how he knew them. He'd been brought up in a rather superior family, but even the Trelawneys were often stupid and insensitive. Even Plaxey knew very little about herself. She was so absorbed in herself that she couldn't see herself, couldn't see the wood for the trees. How often she was unreasonable and self-righteous because of some miserable little self-regard that she herself didn't spot. But he spotted it all right, oh yes. And she could be cruel. She could make him feel an outcast and a worm just for spite. What enraged him most of all about human beings, and particularly the superior ones that he met in Cambridge, was their self-deception. Every one of them was quite different, really, from the mask that he or she presented to the world. McBain, for instance. Of course, he really was devoted to science, up to a point, but more so to himself. And he daren't admit it, even to himself. Why couldn't he just say, "Oh, I know I'm a selfish brute at heart, but I try not to be." Instead, he pretended to have a real sheepdog loyalty to science. But he didn't really use himself up for science. Perhaps he might some day, just as Thomas did. Some day he might be ready to die for science, even. But if he did, he would really be dying not absolutely for science, but for his own reputation as a devoted scientist. Oh, God! What a species to rule a planet! And so obtuse about everything that wasn't human, so incapable of realizing imaginatively any other kind of spirit than the human. Had not even Plaxey failed him? And cruel, spiteful. Had not even Plaxey had her claws in him? And complacent. Did not even Plaxey really, in her secret heart, regard him as just a dog. But what a universe, anyhow. No use blaming human beings for what they were. Everything was made so that it had to torture something else. Sirius himself, no exception, of course, made that way. Nothing was responsible for being by nature predatory on other things, dog on rabbit, and Argentine beef. Man on nearly everything, bugs and microbes on man, and of course man himself on man. Nothing but man was really cruel, vindictive, except perhaps the loathly cat. Everything desperately struggling to keep its nose above water for a few breaths before its strengths inevitably failed and down it went, pressed under by something else. And beyond, those brainless, handless, idiotic stars, blazing away so importantly for nothing. Here and there some speck of a planet dominated by some half-awake intelligence like humanity. And here and there on such planets, one or two poor little spirits waking up and wondering what in hell everything was for, and what it was all about, what they could make of themselves, and glimpsing in a muddled way what their potentiality was, and feebly trying to express it, but always failing, always missing fire, and very often feeling themselves breaking up, as he himself was doing. Just now and then they might find the real thing in some creative work or in sweet community with another little spirit or with others. Just now and then they seemed somehow to create or to be gathered up into something lovelier than their individual selves, something which demanded their selves sacrifice and yet gave their selves new life. But how precariously, torturingly, and only just for a flicker of time. Their whole lifetime would only be a flicker. In the whole of Titanic time. Even when all the worlds have frozen or exploded and all the sun's gone dead and cold, there'll still be time. Oh, God! What for?